transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, how you doing? Welcome to the show. This week, I am so excited to let you know that actor Sean Kanan, who plays Deacon Sharp on The Young and the Restless, and who also had the iconic role of bad boy Mike Barnes in Karate Kid Part 3, joins us to talk about his very successful career and his involvement in anti-bullying. Our relationship coach, Frank B. Kermit, also stops by to talk about how important it is to understand compromise and respect in your relationship. Not to mention a killer remix from Jesse J. Let's go!
Capture your need for sound.
You've seen my next guest all over television and movie screens, including his starring turn in Karate Kid Part 3 opposite Ralph Macchio. He's also made quite a name for himself on daytime television, playing roles on General Hospital, Sunset Beach, Bold and the Beautiful, and most recently, the number one soap opera on television, Young and the Restless, as bad boy Deacon Sharp. It's a great pleasure to welcome actor, writer, producer, and stand-up comedian Sean Kanan to the Kelly Alexander Show. Sean, thanks for hanging out with us today.
Kelly, thanks so much for having me.
Now, Sean, I know you have a very important message to share about bullying and all the work that you've been doing to battle this behavior, but if we could just sort of set the scene for a second, I'd like to go back to your childhood. Were you ever bullied as a kid?
Absolutely, I was. You know, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, I was on the receiving end of quite a bit of bullying when I was a younger kid, and I think that's what made it so surreal almost for me to find myself years later playing the bully in Karate Kid 3. Somehow my earlier experience kind of helped me, achieve kind of a sense of compassion, I guess, and understanding. And I just have always really hated bullying. And, I'm very happy now that I've got the opportunity to hopefully make a difference and do something about it.
Now, as a kid, did you want to be an actor, and was that playing a part in why you were bullied as a kid?
Yes, I wanted to be an actor, and no, I don't think it did, because by the time I really knew that I wanted to be an actor and, had begun to verbalize that to other people, I was probably around 14 or 15, and I had a kind of a weird metamorphosis in my life. I was a chubby kid. I was a Jewish kid in an almost entirely, non-Jewish school. There were a lot of targets that were sort of painted on me. By the time I was 13, I had started taking karate. I had lost a lot of weight. I really underwent an outward change, but on the inside, I still sort of felt like this chubby kid that was awkward and got picked on. I just wasn't a chubby kid getting picked on anymore.
And with regards to you actually landing that role, the role opposite Ralph Macchio, where you played the bully, Mike Barnes, was your martial arts training a reason why, like a part of the reason why you actually got cast in that very special role?
Well, it was absolutely a prerequisite to have martial arts ability to get that role. It's an interesting story how I landed that role. I was taking karate in Pennsylvania, and my teacher in Pennsylvania joined an organization called the Japan Karate Federation in California. And the head of the Japan Karate Federation is a Japanese gentleman named Fumio Demura. And it just so happened that Mr. Demura was Pat Morita's stunt double. And as I came to know Sensei Demura, he knew I wanted to act, and he told me, he said, look, they're going to be doing an open call to find the heavy, the villain for Karate Kid 3. You should try and, get in on this. And by that time, I was living in Los Angeles. I did have an agent. I think I had worked one or two small TV jobs. And so I showed up at the casting director's office, and I said, listen, I said, I'm a real actor. I said, I'd like an audition, please. And I thought she would just be so happy to have a guy like me, savor the trouble of this open call. And she said, well, that's great. You can wait in line with everybody else. And so I was a little bit dejected, but I was absolutely determined that I was going to get this role because I just thought it was perfect for me. And I showed up at the studio the next day, and there were like literally 2,000 people waiting in line to get a shot at auditioning. And, you know, there was Entertainment Tonight was there, and there was it was a bit of a spectacle. And John Adelson, who was the director of all the Karate Kid movies and who had also won the Oscar for directing Rocky, was walking up the line with a couple of his assistants and a camera crew, et cetera. And he made his way towards me, and I knew that I was going to have a very, very brief moment to make a very big impression on this guy if I was going to have any chance at all. And as he came close to me, we locked eyes, and he stopped, which I knew that was stage one, getting the guy to stop. And at that point, he said, "All right, we're going to do a little improv." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "I want you to intimidate me." And I can't tell you what I said on the air, but I think that I was pretty effective at intimidating him. And he looked at his assistants and he said, "I buy it." And the next thing I know, I was ushered inside the studio, and I was soon face to face with Ralph Macchio, and I was put on a sound stage, and they gave me some lines, and we had another audition, which was actually the screen test, and they proceeded to hire somebody else. And I was absolutely crushed. And I guess the other guy that they hired, they worked with them for about a day and a half, and it just didn't work out. I don't know if it was a function of him not being, you know, the right actor for the part, or that he couldn't understand the martial arts choreography, but whatever it was, he was fired, and they called me back, and the rest is history, as they say.
And what was it like sort of playing this awful bully, Sean? Because like you said, it was sort, you know, you've had the experience of being a child and being bullied. Was it difficult for you to get into that mind space? And because you were very affected, the funny thing is I actually just saw the movie again a couple of days ago. They had it on television, and I saw you in the scenes, and you came across, you know, as very convincing. Was it hard for you?
It wasn't hard for me. It wasn't hard for me because it wasn't until significantly after the film had concluded, and frankly years later, that I really started thinking about the dynamic of being a guy that had been bullied and playing a bully. I think at the time that I was doing it, I was really just too into it. There was too much riding on it. I mean, it was a very, you know, intense experience. No, so it wasn't hard. I mean, what was difficult was that a year before, I was a guy in the audience watching the film as a fan, and I had to very quickly set that aside and you know, be able to recalibrate myself to understand that I was now, you know, an actor with these guys, and I had a job to do, and you know, that was a little bit of an adjustment. In addition to that, you know, I had really not had a lot of acting training. I mean, you know, most of what I had was kind of, you know, some force of personality and charisma, but I didn't have a whole lot of training. I mean, I had just gotten into acting class. You know, for me now, I watch Karate Kid, and I kind of shudder because all I see is an extremely young, untrained, undisciplined kid. But you know what? It's also nice because I can see where I've come from there.
Joining us on the show is actor Sean Kanan, currently seen as Deacon Sharp on Young and the Restless. Make sure you check him out, www.seankananent.com. Now, Sean, earlier this year, you went off to Washington to lobby on behalf of the Anti-Defamation League on topics like anti-bullying and sexual orientation inclusion. Why did you get involved in this, and what are you trying to accomplish?
I got involved with the Anti-Defamation League because I was watching the news, and I remember that I was literally yelling at the TV screen. I was like apoplectic. I had seen one of these stories, yet another story about, you know, some kid getting bullied and ultimately took his own life. And I'm yelling at the TV, and then I kind of had an epiphany. I said to myself, you know, what the hell are you doing about it? And if you're not doing something about it, then you're part of the problem. And apathy is one of the biggest issues that, you know, I think it's one of the biggest evils in life is apathy. And I had received an email from the Anti-Defamation League, just kind of like a blanket email, and I decided I'm going to respond to it. And I responded. The next thing I know, I'm having lunch with a woman named Margot Howard, who is in charge of major gifts for the Anti-Defamation League. She goes out and she does fundraisers. And she asked me if I would be interested in joining something called the Glass Leadership Institute, which is sort of a select group that they put together. They train you for a year. You have monthly meetings. We have speakers like, you know, everything from hate crime specialists in the police department to prosecutors who do capital murders to, district court judges, you know, high-level judges. Very, very interesting stuff. And it culminates at the conference that we just had in Washington, D.C., where we had some brilliant speakers. I mean, no matter what your political affiliation is, you know, Republican, Democrat, independent, whatever, we were privileged to hear people like John Lewis, who is a representative who came from parents who were sharecroppers. We heard the minority whip Steny Hoyer speak. We heard Michael Oren, who is he's the Israeli ambassador to the United States. And it was just fascinating. And while the Anti-Defamation League is concerned with a lot of issues, one of the biggest ones is, the issues of Israel, its right to exist. It combats anti-Semitism. It combats bigotry and racism. And we consider ourselves to be the premier human rights organization. It's very interested in dealing with bullying, and now specifically cyberbullying. Because, you know, when I was a kid, there was no cyberbullying, and now it's given people the ability to bully people anonymously. And I think for some reason, people are pushed to the limits of their worst behavior, hiding behind the anonymity of the internet. And most kids now have cell phones, so that they're constantly texting and they're constantly hooked in 24 hours a day. So they're not just getting bullied at school. Kids are getting bullied via text message and Facebook, et cetera. And, I just decided that was an area within the Anti-Defamation League where I really wanted to try and concentrate, you know, my abilities. And one of the great things about being on a show like The Young and the Restless is that it affords me a springboard and a forum that allows me to bring attention to some of these issues.
And do you think, Sean, that parents, schools, and communities are finally taking bullying seriously and that things are starting to change for the better? Because, and like you mentioned, this cyberbullying, people can stay faceless and it's just insane.
Yes, I do. I think it's significantly better. Yes, I think people are starting to realize that, you know, bullying is not just an adolescent rite of passage, that bullying is incredibly damaging, often resulting in serious harm, if not death, and it leaves psychic scars for people, you know? And so I think that educators are really starting to step things up. I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And again, I say, you know, no matter what your political affiliations are, I think we need to, you know, commend the current administration for having the first White House summit about bullying. I think that's great. And, I think another thing that's starting to change, and it needs to change more, but parents are starting to understand that when your kid is complaining that they're being picked on, or maybe they're just withdrawn and not communicating and talking to you, or if they're choosing to express themselves through Facebook or the internet saying, I'm really unhappy, I hate school, nobody understands me, I'm getting picked on. I think parents are starting to finally give that the gravity that it deserves. And you know, for parents and teachers, what they need to do, I think, is A, be very vigilant and look for these sort of signs, and B, be there for the kids so that they know that they can talk to you and communicate without judgment. I mean, one of the biggest reasons that I think kids don't go to teachers, don't go to adults, is they don't think that they're going to be understood. They think that they're going to be judged. And they also fear that the situation is either not going to get worse or it's going to elicit, you know, a geometrically worse reprisal. And if parents and teachers and adults in general create an atmosphere where kids feel safe to talk to them, I think that's going to make a big difference. And one other thing, and I'm sorry, I realize I'm blathering on here a bit, but I just think it's important, is that I really think that when parents and even other kids, when you see something going on that's bullying or wrong, you got to do something. And if you don't feel confident to step in and try and do something physically, which is understandable, you know, you at least have to, you know, verbalize a protest and, you know, say something like, hey, we're not going to tolerate it. That kind of behavior is not okay. And I think when bullying reaches a level where it's just utterly socially unaccepted on any level, then I think that we're going to see it begin to get truly eradicated.
Okay, I think that's fantastic. And I think it's great, like you mentioned earlier, that the fact that you have a name for yourself and you can actually bring attention to this cause is fantastic. You know, and being on Young and the Restless, that has such a good platform. And I have to ask you some Young and the Restless questions, Sean, because I know you have ardent fans. I am one of them. I'm a huge Young and the Restless fan. And I just wanted to mention, because if people have only been watching you either on Bold and the Beautiful and Young and the Restless, they may not remember that you actually were AJ Quartermain on General Hospital years ago. So you've been in daytime for a long time. I watched that show too. Sean, is it difficult to be in the daytime genre? Because I know daytime actors work extremely hard.
It's difficult, probably not for the reasons that you may think it's difficult. I think people's assumption is daytime's difficult because the hours must be really hard and it's a lot of dialogue and that sort of thing. That's actually not what's difficult about it. What's difficult is I'm an actor. I'm not a daytime actor. I'm an actor. And it's difficult that sometimes there's a stigma that makes it difficult for me when I pursue other jobs. And that's difficult. You know, if people knew what goes into one of our shows, I'll just explain this for a second. When you do a theater piece, you rehearse for 6 weeks, and you have the luxury of really discovering your character and really being well rehearsed. If you do a movie, you shoot 5 or 6 pages a day. We shoot 60 pages a day. We get one take. And when you're working in that environment, it's just not conducive to getting the best final product possible. It's just, it is what it is. That's the nature of the beast. And when you do daytime, you know that those are the constraints with which you're working under. And I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that, you know, when you see good work on daytime, It truly is, it runs contrary to how the deck is sort of stacked against doing good work, if that makes sense. So I see a lot of really talented people in daytime, and I think sometimes daytime actors, which I don't think they're daytime actors, I think they're actors who happen to be doing daytime, I think sometimes people get a little dismissive of the people working in daytime, and that's kind of difficult. For that reason, I'm always looking to do other things outside of daytime. I'm starting a film May 7th, which I'm really excited about. I hope we get a chance to talk about that for a few minutes.
Yes, go on.
I do love working on daytime, and I do love my character. I wish my character was working a little more. It's been a little frustrating for me to have gone from working on Bold and the Beautiful, where I, you know, kind of consistently had a front burner storyline, to, you know, working 5-6 shows a month. But you know what? We have a large cast. We have a lot of people who've been there longer than I have. And so I'm fortunate and happy to have what I have. Hoping at some point that I get an expanded storyline so that they let me have the ball and run with it.
Okay. I just have 2 more questions about the daytime thing. And it's really, sure. With regards to you working on Young and the Restless alongside these veteran soap stars like Melody Thomas-Scott, who plays Nikki, and Eric Braeden, who plays Victor. What's it like working alongside them? Because like you said, there's people that have been there long before you. Is it fun working with such a pair that have been around for so long?
Yeah, it is. I mean, they've got a tremendous chemistry together that's undeniable. I have incredible admiration for Eric Braeden. I think he's a really interesting man. I think he's a great actor, and he has been nothing but unbelievably kind to me, and which is strange, because yesterday, you know, we had a show. I can't tell you what's going on, but suffice it to say that Deacon has done a lot of things to engender Victor's wrath. And, you know, thank goodness Eric is very capable of separating the two of those things. But I had always said to myself years ago when I was working on Bold and Beautiful that I wanted to work with Eric. And I had to remember that if I ever found myself in a storyline with Victor Newman, that I had to take a second and pause and say, you know what, you're working with the best of the best now, and like relish that. And so I do. I mean, I feel really, really fortunate to work with Melody and to work with to Eric. You know, Melody, we did a scene yesterday, and, you know, you get used to working with the actors, and, you know, yes, everyone's good, but every now and then somebody does something, and you're reminded of just kind of how good they are. And Melody did some stuff yesterday. I went up after the scene and I gave her a kiss. And I just said, wow, you know, Mel, that was really, really, that was terrific work. And I'm very honored to work with you. So, yeah, I love working with those guys.
And as an actor who does work in daytime, with the recent announcement of All My Children and One Life to Live being taken off the air in the next couple months, do you have concerns about the future of daytime? Or do you think that, you know, Young and the Restless, Bold and the Beautiful, General Hospital, and Days of Our Lives, those are the four soaps that are going to be left? Do you think they will continue on for years to come?
I don't know. I mean, look, at the end of the day, it's a business. We're fortunate that the Young and the Restless is signed on for another 2 years with Sony. The Bold and the Beautiful has such an enormous presence internationally that I think that that also is one of the things that, you know, gives it a strong chance of staying on here. I don't know. I mean, you know, obviously there's been a tremendous contraction in the marketplace. I'm very, very sorry for those people whose shows went off the air. My heart goes out to them. I mean, it's a really difficult thing. I just don't know. I mean, it's become probably more expensive to do soap operas than it is to produce a lot of these Fox shows, which certainly, you know, makes them a target for elimination. I really hope that the fans, who are the lifeblood of these shows, voice their support and voice their, you know, their desire to keep us on the air.
Okay. And Sean, before I let you go, I just have to ask you, can you give us a little bit of a hint about what's coming up with that movie that you talked about? Because I believe it's called My Trip Back to the Dark Side.
Yeah, My Trip Back to the Dark Side. Interesting story. I did a film called My Trip to the Dark Side. It has not come out yet. It just won the gold medal at the World Fest, which is a huge film festival. I'm sorry, I'm at the ATM right now. I'm on a multicast, leaving town tonight. And so anyway, the director, who's a dear friend of mine, a guy named Shane Stanley, who produced a film called The Gridiron Gang with The Rock, which was the number one film at the box office when it came out, was able to raise the money and get a distribution deal to do the sequel. So we're actually filming the sequel to a movie that has not even come out yet. I'm reprising my role of David Prince. The basic storyline is about a guy, not me, who is a producer in Hollywood, a real good guy, married, new baby, on the way, and he wants to make this project that is his dream project, a beautiful film. He loses his financing, and he winds up having to come to me, and I play a guy that is a very powerful producer in adult films, kind of a real seedy guy, but a, you know, a very powerful, successful guy. And long story short, he has to make a deal with the devil to ultimately make his film, and his trip to the dark side refers to him, you know, entering into that shadow world of adult filmmaking.
Okay, and any idea when we're going to be able to see these two films?
I would say, well, I think the first one probably in the next several months. The next one, you know, usually when you do a film, it takes a year, you know, between, you know, editing and marketing and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But, I mean, everybody, if everybody would love to, you know, sign on to my Twitter, it's Sean Cannon at Twitter. I keep everybody apprised of everything I'm doing because, I mean, you know, the fans are, one of the, you know, they're just so important. They really are. I know a lot of people say that, but especially with me, I mean, you know, I've had some very public bouts of having my ups and downs, and the fans have really rallied around me, and their kindness and their support has made an enormous difference in my career. And, you know, if I could just take a moment to to thank everybody. I really mean it. And I hope I do my best to entertain you for a long time to come.
Sean, thank you so much. And I really wish you the best of luck as well with everything going on with the anti-bullying thing. It's been fantastic. I think you're doing a great thing.
Thanks, Kelly. Thanks, everybody, for being here.
That's actor, writer, producer, and stand-up comedian Sean Kanan. Check him out, SeanKananENT.com.
Oh,
It's a very different ball game from when you go from being a single person to being in a committed relationship. You have to make that mental and emotional mind shift that things are not just about you anymore. But at the same time, you can't lose yourself in being part of a couple. It's a very delicate balance, to say the least. So to give us an idea how to handle healthy compromise and respect for yourself and your partner is relationship coach Frank B. Kermit. Frank, thanks so much for coming back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks, Kelly. Great to be here again.
Frank, is one of the first things you need to be clear about to yourself before getting involved with anyone your own idea of personal boundaries? And can you give us an idea of what those things might be?
Absolutely. Before you get into a committed relationship, you need to know what your deal breakers are. Things that you will tolerate very well and that you expect from your partner, and things that you will not tolerate well at all, that if they start to happen in the relationship, it will mean the end of that relationship. So let's go through a couple of examples here. We'll choose something pretty benign. Let's say your personal boundary is you don't want to be with someone who smokes cigarettes. And this is something that is easy to define. If you want to date somebody, they can't be smokers. Maybe you have asthma, or maybe you just don't like the smell. If you start dating someone, and it turns out that the person that you really, really like is a social smoker, well, if you really know yourself, you'll know that you cannot deal with that type of issue because it's a personal boundary, and you just won't get serious with the person from the very beginning. It's prevention rather than cure. But if it turns out that, well, I really, really like this person, and I guess I don't mind the social smoking so much, well, this is a sign that you don't really know what your boundaries are. And although, you're going to have a relationship after that, it is a sign that there's a possible red flag in the future because you might be wishy-washy about other boundaries. Now, you might not actually be wishy-washy, but that's the way it's going to be communicated to your partner. If you're not going to be firm on your boundaries from the beginning of the relationship because you're constantly changing them, the day comes when you really mean, no, I will not tolerate this, your partner is just likely not to believe you.
And Frank, a question I had for you in just what you said, if you sort of have this red flag, like with the smoking, you know, the social smoking, and you're like, yeah, I don't know about this. And then in your own mindset, you sort of, you know, well, I know I'm not going to take this very seriously. How do you not, or do you tell the other person? Like, do you, because it's almost like it's a mental shift that's happened in your head saying like, you know what, this person already has this against them. I know I'm not going to take it seriously, so I'm just going to have some fun. Like, to me, that's not good. Do you communicate that right away, or do you just sort of keep it to yourself? Because it feels like you're lying to them.
Well, if you reach a point where you really feel that you're not going to see the person seriously, and then this is just for fun, when that topic comes up in conversation, where the person says, you know, well, what are we exactly, and where do we stand? You're going to have to be honest with the person and say, I don't see a future here, because our values are different. And you will communicate to that person what values you're talking about that matter to you. Okay. In the case of, let's say, dating a smoker where, okay, the person smokes socially, I know that I can never get really serious with this person because I have asthma. Well, if, you know, you date the person, you enjoy their time, but as soon as the person starts saying, you know, do you ever see us lasting together in the future? Do you see where this relationship is going? You be honest. You say, actually, I don't see a future for this relationship. And you can say exactly what your reason is. Long term, I don't want to be with someone who smokes even socially because I have asthma. So unless, you know, something like that changes, well, it's not even an idea I'm going to entertain. Now, I know that seems really harsh, but one of the risks of going out and having a relationship is that you're going to meet people you like but still can't make it work with them. And that's okay. That's one of the risks you're going to deal with. And if you're just not comfortable dealing with the risks or dealing with potential confrontation or dealing with loss, then those are separate issues as to whether or not you want to be in a relationship.
Now, Frank, how do you really come to understand your boundaries and deal breakers? Because, you know, just like you sort of mentioned earlier, you might have it in your head that you will never deal with, you know, a smoker or someone who's a workaholic. But then, you know, you meet this person, and even though they do work a lot and they don't devote as much time to you as you would like, you really like them. You really, and like, it's even surprised you that it's making you sort of rethink your earlier boundaries and deal breakers. Like, what do you do there? Because it seems like it's, you know, you're even doubting yourself in that moment.
It's very important that from as early as you can to get as much relationship experience as you can and to date as many different people as possible. One of my personal rules is I will only date someone once a week until I have any reason to see them more often or get more serious. And by dating them once a week, I'm still dating others. In my philosophy, commitment of that sort or monogamy of that sort must be earned. There has to be a reason that I would not see other people while I'm seeing person number one, unless it's a monogamous lifestyle you want. If you want to have a monogamous lifestyle, then you need to see the person as often as possible, so that way you can make a judgment much sooner about whether or not you want to see this person long term. And as soon as you say, no, I don't see this going long term, end the relationship, be ethical about it, don't lead somebody on, move on to the next person that you want to get to know. The more people you date and the more life experience you have, the more you're going to find whether or not you can actually handle a particular boundary. On paper, everything looks good. Well, I'm going to want this kind of relationship. But if you're not realistic in other areas of your life in terms of, you know, let's say you're thinking for an employment career. I mean, you're going to have to be realistic that certain types of jobs require a work schedule that you might not like. You don't go into it thinking, well, the industry is going to change for me. Well, no, you have to be realistic, and it's the same thing with relationships. You have to set realistic boundaries and deal breakers. And if you're not realistic about it, you're going to find out pretty quickly where your boundaries actually are. The second part of this is that there's a difference between what people like and what people respond to. And it's so important to realize that when we're talking about relationships, we're talking about emotional needs, and emotions are not logical. So you might have wonderful ideas about who you would like to date, but if you respond to a certain type of person that does things that would be against your boundaries and deal breakers on paper, you need to come to terms with that and work on yourself to reach some sort of resolution.
Joining us on the show is relationship coach Frank B. Kermit. You can check him out at www.franktalks.com. Frank, I'm assuming that if you do realize something that you thought you could handle, but then in reality you can't, you better be honest with yourself and your partner that you can't compromise, because I'm assuming in the long run it's going to blow up in your faces anyway.
Exactly. What tends to happen with couples whose values are not being respected because they may have a boundary or deal breaker, they may not have even realized how important it was to them, but they're starting to feel violated. Even though everybody was honest in the beginning and you did go into it with a fresh heart and ready to take the chance, if you feel that your boundaries are being crossed, you're going to start feeling resentment. It's an emotional reaction. You don't choose your emotions. You're going to react the way you're going to react. And if you start to feel resentment towards your partner, that resentment will lead to contempt, and these things will break the foundation of even the best possible relationships. Look at people who have been together for many, many years, and you just see that, yes, at some point there was some initial love there. There is still an underlying love and commitment there, but they're just angry at each other, and they're snapping at each other because they've had resentment built up over the years. So let's say you want to get into a relationship with somebody, and let's say the person that you're dating wants to have an open relationship and you've been traditionally monogamous. You don't know how you can handle that, but you say, I'm willing to give it a try. And you start dating and you start understanding that the person you're with is going to see other people. If you are truly a traditionally monogamous person and you're dating someone who only does the open relationship structure and you're not finding yourself adapting to this new type of relationship structure, you're going to start to feel resentment. And even though everybody was honest and everything was fine and everybody is open about what's going on, so there's no infidelity, if you're still feeling that resentment because you're expecting the person to change or you really didn't expect yourself to react this way, you need to come to terms with that. And you need to communicate to your partner and say, look, I thought I could handle this. I really gave it an honest try, but this is not working for me. And it's hurting me, and I'm going to end up hating you. And in that process, I might end up hating myself. This has got to end. The most ethical thing you can do sometimes is to break up with somebody that you are incompatible with. because you're by staying in that kind of relationship, you're not doing the right thing. You're doing the wrong thing. You're hurting everyone involved in ways that the damage can be progressive.
Okay, I think that's very important for people to realize that I don't think you can sweep things under the rug, because eventually the dust is going to build up anyway and come flying out at some point.
That's a beautiful analogy. I couldn't have said it better.
Okay. Thanks, Frank. I feel better now about myself. Frank, I think there's also, a difference between compromising on something you really don't care about and then something you really do care about.
Oh, absolutely. When people talk about you have to compromise in a relationship, what they're saying is the stuff that's not that important to you, ignore it, forget it, let the other person have their way if it's important to them. But you never compromise on your values, and you never compromise on those boundaries and deal breakers, because that's when the resentment starts to build. Let's say you are, in terms of a lifestyle here or in terms of eating habits, let's say you're a vegetarian, and it's something that's really important to you. Well, dating someone who eats meat and who brings meat into your house, and you have certain rules about that, if you start compromising on something that is such a fundamental part of your lifestyle, you're going to start to feel resentment, even as great as the person is, because the vegetarianism lifestyle is very important to you. That's not something you compromise on.
Okay.
However, let's say it's a matter of the color of the wallpaper in various rooms in the apartment or the house. Let's say you really don't care either way. If it's blue, or if it's green, or if it's polka dots, or a pattern, or whatnot. If stuff like that really is not that important to you, those are the things you compromise on because you figure, well, doesn't mean that much to me. Well, what do you think, honey? Do you like it? Do you have a preference? Maybe your partner has this thing where they like a very particular color. They absolutely want Viking blue on the wall and ceiling. Okay, if it's not something that is going to challenge your boundaries and your deal breakers, those are the things you compromise on.
Let's say you are compromising on the color of the wall because you don't really care. I find that sometimes then the person who ended up compromising it, say, yeah, honey, I don't really care, you know, go for it, whatever, it's all good. Eventually, I feel like they make a bigger deal out of the fact that they did compromise, like later on the road, like down the road, like it could come up in an argument or something, say, well, you know, it's not like I don't compromise. I compromise all the time. I let you have that blue color you wanted. And it's like you make it a bigger deal than it was and still is to you initially. It's almost like you're grasping at something to prove your point in that current situation. Does that make sense to you, what I'm saying?
Absolutely, it does make sense. We're human beings. And the one thing about human beings that you can be pretty well guaranteed, no matter how little or how much somebody compromises, everybody feels they compromise too much. And that is not a sign that they're being taken advantage of in the relationship. Usually, there's a major issue going on that people are afraid to talk about, so they start picking on a lot of smaller things because that is what's triggering the anger, but the anger and the resentment is already there. I might turn around and say, you know, I compromise a lot because I agree to let the wallpaper be yellow in the entire house. But what's really bothering me is that chances are the person that I'm with has violated my boundaries in some other area, but maybe I'm too afraid to talk about what's really bugging me, because if it is a core value of mine that's being violated, it could spell the end of the relationship. So always remember that when people fight about things, especially on the issue of compromise, they're not necessarily fighting about the particular things they bring up. It might be a symptom that there's a core hurt going on somewhere there, and they're afraid to bring up that core hurt.
And I think that the person, and both people, I think you really need to be self-aware that that's what's going on, because I think it's like you get caught up in the little details, which really aren't anything, when it's something, you know, the elephant in the room that you're not talking about.
Exactly. Whenever people fight about the small things, whether or not the toilet seat is up or down, or whether the toilet paper roll is over the top or down the back, those things just are not that important. Usually there's a much deeper issue that nobody's talking about because they're afraid that communication might be the end of the relationship. What most people don't realize is that if there's an underlying resentment there, that more than anything is going to spell the end of your relationship.
In a relationship, is compromise ever equal, or does it inevitably sort of end up being that one of the people involved ends up compromising more or less?
I always look at it, I get this question actually quite a bit, because I deal with couples who, again, they've built up some resentment over the years. Here's what I let them know. As long as your core values and boundaries are being respected, it doesn't matter who's compromising more, who's compromising less. It's a wonderful intellectual construct that everything is going to be equal and everything is going to be down the line. And the fact is, we're human beings, and the theory just does not work in practice. There's always going to be one person who compromises a bit more than the other, but that's because one person might have a lot of really important values and boundaries that they want, and the other person might be a lot more easygoing, where they want the main things looked after, and then for the other stuff, let the other person have their way, because they really don't care. So yeah, there's always going to be one person who feels that they're compromising more than another. And in fact, the person who's compromising less usually feels that they're compromising more than their other partner. The key here is what you're compromising on. If you're compromising on stuff that really isn't that important, but the main values in the relationship are being respected, your main boundaries and deal breakers are being respected, then it's all good. It's when the main things that you really value are being crossed. And then that's when you have a problem. And all the other stuff just becomes an annoyance, because at the core of it, you're not feeling respected in the relationship.
How do you truly respect your partner in a relationship, Frank? Because I feel like this is different than respecting yourself.
Usually what I recommend is that you find out exactly how your partner wants to be treated. Because we all take the attitude, I'm going to treat others the way I would want to be treated. And again, intellectual construct, works on paper, but in real life, how I want to be treated in a situation might be different from the way someone else wants to be treated. So I need to find out how my partner wants to be treated in that particular situation and whether or not that treatment is in line with my current value system. If it is, treat the partner how they want to be treated. So let's just choose a particular example, right? You mentioned the workaholic earlier in this interview. So let's say one of the partners is a workaholic, and they come home, and the way the workaholic would want to be treated is not to be asked about work. They don't want to think about work when they come home, and they may turn around and say to their partner, you know what, go off, go have fun with your job, go have fun with your career, just do it, I support you. Meanwhile, the partner is saying, well, I want to hear about your day. I want to hear about your job. I want to feel a sense of connection with you again. So in that case, both of them want the same thing. They want to encourage one another. They want to connect with each other. But one of them wants something that the other one wouldn't want. And it's very important to realize that it's not just about you. You have to treat your partner the way your partner wants to be treated, because that's when your partner feels respected or special.
Okay, Frank, that's a lot of work. I guess just to sort of round things out with regards to compromise and respect, if you are in a relationship and you feel like things are, you know, the ship is leaning over way too far to the left, how do you right the ship, and how do you know when to abandon ship?
Okay, when the ship is leaning too far to one side than another, first of all, you have to take responsibility for that. Nobody can really take advantage of you without your permission. Ann Landers taught me that. So if you really feel that you're giving up way too much in this relationship, you have to come to the issue of why you allowed that to happen to yourself. Because at any time, you could have put your foot down on something earlier. This is where we look at your own repeating behavior pattern. So if you can identify the repeating behavior pattern that got you into this situation to begin with, that's when you're in a position to not make that mistake again in the future. Because even if you jump ship and you go with someone else, chances are it's going to happen again. Because the issue is you at that point. How do you rectify the situation? Well, you talk to your partner and you say, look, I can't deal with these specific things, and these specific things have to stop. because if they don't stop, I can't continue in this type of relationship because I'm feeling violated. I'm not feeling right about this. It's not working for me. Now, if your partner turns around and says, well, I really don't care what you think. I'm just going to go ahead and do my thing. That's a pretty good sign when it's time to jump ship, because it means that your partner is not interested in your boundaries or helping you feel balanced or healthy, emotionally healthy in the relationship. If your partner says, okay, let's see what we can do. What is it you need? And this is where you have to know yourself, and you have to know exactly what it is that you need in a relationship in order to make it work for yourself. This is a very frustrating thing for most people because they don't know what it is they need, but they expect their partners to figure it out. And that isn't fair to the partner. So if you're going to say to your partner, I don't know what it is I need, but this isn't it. Well, it's not your partner's responsibility to figure out what makes you happy, especially when you don't know. This is where emotional maturity comes in, because only an immature person expects the other person to figure out all of their problems and their particular idiosyncrasies. Okay. You have to be able to communicate what you need, and if you don't know, don't expect your partner to figure it out. It's up to you to figure it out. At that point, maybe you shouldn't be in a relationship. Maybe you should spend some time alone and learning about yourself. But that can be really, really scary to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Frank, I think this has just been fantastic. I really appreciate your time on this today. Thank you.
Kelly, I absolutely love being on your show. I can't wait to do it again.
Thank you so much. That is Frank B. Kermit, relationship coach, and make sure to check him out. He's awesome. www.franktalks.com.
Bring on the remix.
Jesse J and B.O.B. with Price Tag, remixed by Jason Nevins on The Kelly Alexander Show. We also featured the amazing Mary J. Blige earlier on with her hit song from 2001, No More Drama. Well, you know what? Another show come and gone. Thank you so much to my amazing guests, including actor Sean Kanan. Love him so much on The Young and the Restless and can't wait for him to come back and join us on the show again. Also to our relationship coach, Frank Kermit. Always amazing advice. Don't forget to check them out, www.franktalks.com. And you know what? Please make sure to join us next week on the show, because we're going to chat with Julie Rom. She's an author of the book Military Kids Speak. And that's a book actually about what life is like for kids who grow up in the military. It's very fascinating stuff, and I can't wait for you to listen in. Any comments or questions, drop me a note, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.